Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As the U.S.-Israel war in Iran continues unabated, it's important to ask which side has escalation dominance. Also, the world has changed. Before, the U.S. could weaponize the global economy. Now it finds the global economy weaponized against it. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out here with Mark. Well, we're, of course, chronicling this conflict as we go along. It seems to be a number of important shifts going on. We had kind of asymmetrical warfare at the same time. It's attrition. We had Trump already declare victory, and now he's apparently sending troops to the region. And probably the most important development is now it's turning into an economic infrastructure war, which has very, very serious global dimensions, Mark.
Yeah, so Trump has been quite clear that the U.S. military has completely obliterated Iran. They no longer have any military forces yet. And a writer for The Economist opined on Twitter X that indeed the U.S. has destroyed 100% of Iran's military capability, but that pesky 0% capability is inflicting severe economic damage on the U.S. allied countries in the region with military bases that the U.S. is carrying out their attacks on Iran from. The propaganda coming out of the White House may be a little absurdist emperor with no clothes at this point. Iran has shifted the nature of this conflict, as you pointed out. It started out with U.S.-Israeli decapitation strikes on the Iranian government's leadership, which failed to achieve the results of regime change that, you know, we and many other people, you know, suspected would not result in. And then it became a kind of long-range strike war of attrition, primarily against military facilities and units on each side. But now, with all of the impetus being from the U.S.-Israeli side, it has started to shift to an energy infrastructure and economic war of attrition. Of course, Iran has selectively closed the Strait of Hormuz, except for its own and allied shipping, which are still going through. The U.S. Navy has made quite clear that it's not going in there because it understands that they would suffer tremendous losses trying to break it open or escort ships through. And Trump's attempts to cajole his other allies and vassals into doing the same isn't having much effect. And now, as this desperation goes, we see the U.S. is moving up the escalation ladder with a response to targeting. They targeted this week Iran's South Pars gas field, which is the largest natural gas field in the world. And Iran immediately, I mean, they have an escalation ladder playbook. They responded in kind and hit Qatari LNG facilities. Qatar is the second biggest exporter of LNG in the world. And the facilities they hit are worth tens of billions of dollars and will take them years to rebuild, meaning even if this conflict ends.
But we're talking about escalation dominance here. Let me throw it to George here. I mean, we see both. Who is driving it? It looks like the Americans and the Israelis are, with the Israelis taking the lead. Again, Israel humiliated the American president again, which he seems to get away with impunity again. George.
No, you're absolutely right, Peter, because what had happened was that last September, when Israel had hit Qatar and had attempted to assassinate a Hamas negotiator, this was a hugely painful experience for Qatar. And Trump had to go to Qatar and say, this will never, never, never happen again. And he even had Benjamin Netanyahu in the Oval Office make a public telephone call to Qatar, pledging that, well, there will be no more attacks on Qatar. So now, you know, basically this has been, that pledge has been thrown out of the window because of that, the gas field that Mark was referring to was a gas field that's jointly shared by Iran and Qatar. Right. And so, you know, Iran immediately retaliated against Qatar. But this is now what's happening. So Trump continues to insist, oh, well, we've degraded everything. You know, Navy is destroyed. All their launchers are destroyed. But it is clear that Iran is capable of retaliating at any moment. And it's always a very measured, very graduated retaliation. So if it's capable of doing that, then the question already raises, well, what else is it capable of? So just if we think about what has happened in the recent days, we've had the strike or the attempted strike on the Diego Garcia base, which is apparently means that Iran has a ballistic missile capability that has far greater range than had previously been believed.
4,000 kilometers.
Yes, exactly. And then, of course, we had the attack on Dimona in southern Israel, which is the town that houses Israel's nuclear program. Now, the facility was not hit, but the town was hit. So Iran clearly showed we can strike your nuclear facilities. But this was in response to an Israeli attack on the Natanz Iranian nuclear facility. So Iran is now clearly is showing, you want to escalate against us, we will escalate against you.
You know, Mark, also there's, as we're speaking now, another ultimatum, open the Strait of Hormuz or else, okay? I mean, this is just getting to be like the dog that called wolf, Mark.
So the question that you asked, that we still haven't quite got to, who has escalation dominance, right? The U.S. and Israel are still in the initiative seat. Iran is still playing defensive response, but they're obviously demonstrating the tit-for-tat capability to respond and perhaps each time move a bit higher up the escalation ladder, showing, at least for the moment, the assessment of Politico and others, and I agree, is that Iran has the escalation dominance. You hit Bushehr nuclear power plant and the Natanz enrichment facilities, will hit Dimona. Now Trump is threatening that unless you open the Strait of Hormuz in 24 hours, I will destroy all of Iran's electrical generation plants and capability and, you know, send the country back to the Stone Age. Well, Iran can do the same thing to all of the U.S. Gulf state allies in the region.
And including Israel.
Including Israel. And they've demonstrated that they still have the missile and drone capability, which they've actually been increasing the tempo and number of their attacks in the last few days of this week. So again, we are in an escalation spiral. And if Trump keeps going down that path, which he doesn't seem to have the political will to admit that he's lost and you know, suffer the consequences of that, you know, or declare some kind of false victory and hope that the Western mainstream media goes along.
Yeah, but the problem with that, George, is that Trump can declare victory all he wants, but the Iranians are not going to accept that outcome. They can continue. And that is the real dilemma. You can make any declaration you want, but the hard reality is this conflict is far from over, George.
It is far from over because, of course, well, in the first place, you know, the Israel lobby that with which now Trump has wholly identified himself, that's not going to allow Trump just to declare victory and call it a day because they say, well, now, you know, the same government remains in power in Tehran, and now They are absolutely full of themselves. Their international prestige has been greatly boosted. They're kind of almost international heroes, you know, much like Vietnam was in the 1970s. Hey, we took on the United States, we took on Israel, and we're standing. So, you know, Israel said, we can't allow this to happen. And of course, you know, after this, Iran would almost certainly move towards developing nuclear weapons. So there's
That's a really important question. Let me throw it to Mark before we go to the break. Is that, do you think, is there a reason for you to believe, Mark, that they may be on the path of developing a weapon now because of this unprovoked attack by the United States and Israel? I mean, the supreme leader, I mean, fatwas go with the supreme leader, okay? So there's a new supreme leader right now. There hasn't been a fatwa against it, so ergo, maybe it's possible now. Mark?
Yeah, if I or any other realist was in charge of Iran, they would already have a nuclear weapon and would be sitting scot-free with Kim Jong-un. But that's not the situation. However, as we understand it, and the Iranian political system is not always easy for us Westerners to understand, it was the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's fatwa saying it was un-Islamic to have nuclear weapons that was preventing Iran from gaining such a strategic deterrent. Now Israel and the U.S. have killed him. And his son, who is the new supreme leader, the Ayatollah Mojtaba Khamenei, he is what the West describes as a hardliner. He is much closer to the IRGC and the security apparatus of Iran. And the U.S. just killed his father, his wife, his children, and his grandchildren and injured him in a strike. If I were him, I would be hot for a nuclear weapon. I would be hot at least for the deterrent value at this point. So the U.S. and Israel, you know, they may have shot themselves in the foot, but the decapitation strikes continue. Israel assassinated the IRGC spokesman, the Larijani, the secretary of the National Security Council, probably the most powerful man and the most pragmatic, who could have engaged in negotiations, as well as the head of the besiege and the intelligence minister this week. They're trying to kill off anyone who could engage in diplomacy at this point.
But George, that would be presumably at cross purposes of what the Trump administration would like.
Well, it would be, because I think Trump.
I mean, it's hard to say. It's hard.
Right, but the Trump administration, I think, does want to get out of this. But he wants to get out of this with at least a modicum of having accomplished something. I mean, you started this. You have to walk away with something. But Iran isn't allowing it to do so, and rightly, because, you know, we're not setting ourselves up for another attack in 6 months. So Iran is now making clear that, well, we want certain things from you, such as the lifting of sanctions, such as the unfreezing of our assets, and a non-aggression treaty, or some version of a non-aggression treaty. In other words, we get a pledge from the United States that you're not going to come back and do this again in a few months.
All right, I want you to hold that thought, because I want to talk about terms and conditions to end this here. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the war on Iran. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle, and we're talking about the war on Iran. Mark, George started enumerating what possible terms and conditions the Iranians may have in this. Is this conceivable in this day and age in Washington and in Tel Aviv that they would actually have to start listening to the conditions of someone else? Be probably the first time in a very, very long time the United States has put itself in such a humiliating position. Mark?
Yeah, the Iranians, according to their account, and I think it's more plausible than what we're hearing out of Trump's Truth Social page, is that they are the ones who have turned down ceasefire demands from the United States on more than three times. Exactly as you said, because they're not going to go through this again in 8 months. And they believe that they have leverage now, as we said, escalation dominance, you know, at least up until the nuclear level. So they're continuing. They're talking, as George enumerated, that they want a guarantee that U.S. and Israel won't attack Israel again, something that they want.
How does that something like that work?
It would have to go through Congress, and then presidents, you know, like the JCPOA, which was, yeah, you can't trust anything like that, right? Congress wouldn't approve that. They want reparations. They want the unfreezing of their assets and removal of all sanctions. And they want the U.S. to withdraw entirely its military bases from the United States. Now,
From the Persian Gulf,
at least. Yeah, the U.S. is not going to do any of those things, right? And while Iran certainly has demonstrated the power capability to survive and inflict tit-for-tat damage, just from a realist position, I don't believe they have the power and the leverage to force the U.S. to do any things, which for the moment puts us at an impasse. They're going to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed. Yep. Until they get those things, and the U.S. is never going to give us those things.
Yeah, but the plot thickens here because of this unprovoked war against Iran. A lot of other countries have been brought into it, particularly the Persian Gulf monarchies. Do they have a say now? I mean, I would imagine that to some degree they have, okay? I mean, neutrality, the sweet smell of neutrality has got to be entering their minds right now. Obviously, each one of these Gulf countries have a different kind of relationship with Iran. But hosting a military establishment for a foreign country like the United States didn't actually work out really very well, did it, George?
It really didn't. And if they were to think in those terms, hey, it's not really a great idea for us. We need to think about working and cooperating with our neighbors. And they were then to ask the United States, you might think about wrapping up your bases. The United States will say, we're not going to do that. And ultimately, there's no real leverage that they have over the United States. If the United States decides we're going to stay here in the Persian Gulf, whether you like it or not, then the United States gets to stay in the Persian Gulf, whether they like it or not. I mean, we've seen this in Iraq. I mean, it was in 2020, following the assassination of General Soleimani, that the Iraqi parliament demanded that the United States leave Iraq. Well, that was already 6 years ago. And it hasn't happened. So the United States just simply isn't going to do it. So I think the United States will stay. Now, what can work for Iran, in terms of some kind of a settlement, is Trump's obvious desire to limit the political damage. I think he's realized that he's in some trouble. I mean, the fact that he sent out that truth saying, "Oh, I'm thinking of wrapping things up," indicates that that's where his mind is. Even though Netanyahu was making sure that don't even go there. So that, I think, could work towards some kind of a settlement. I agree that it's very difficult to see how we can get out of this impasse. But Trump, I think, wants to do it. He really doesn't want to go into an election season with this war's continuing.
Well, no, I think the real concern, Mark, here is what it's doing to the global economy and indirectly or even directly the U.S. dollar. I mean, the ramifications of this there are more questions we can pose than we can possibly answer right now when we think about the ripple effect of what's going on in the global economy. Mark.
Yeah, I have to disagree with George to a certain extent. I don't think the Trump administration or Trump knows what they want. They don't have a plan. They're flailing around. They're talking about winding this thing down one moment, and Trump has ordered two Marine expeditionary units and is talking about storming Harg Island, which would be a Gallipoli level disaster of epic.
Mark, you were in the military. How would you get there? And would you have to break through the Straits of Hormuz? Would it have to be paratroopers? How would you even do that? Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking two Marine expeditionary units. They would have to transit run the entire gauntlet of the Strait of Hormuz with long Iranian coastlines, being attacked by drones, surface drones, being attacked by missiles, being attacked by fast speedboats, being attacked by anti-ship cruise missiles. They might try to use vertical takeoff craft off of those expeditionary units, helicarriers, but they would be subject to Iranian air defense and the same things as well. It's impossible militarily. And what are a few thousand troops going to do? The Iranian military is a million men strong. I mean,
George, even if it got to the island, how would you get them off?
Well, that's the problem. Yes, that's the problem because, of course, if they were to seize the island, which itself would be quite costly, they would be sitting ducks, and therefore they would be under constant attack from Iranian missiles and drones. And obviously, that hasn't been eliminated, so you can't even think about seizing Karg Island while Iran obviously has the missile and drone capability. But I mean, I take Mark's point that Trump has said one thing one day and then something else the next day, even on the same day. However, that would be a very costly adventure. And for him to take such a political risk, because as the casualties would mount, and probably at some point, they would have to make a decision whether it's worth holding on to Karg Island rather than just simply get off and go away. So I think that, you know, Trump, it would make more sense for Trump now to decide that he really has said, he can still say, I've accomplished something, and walk away. But it is going to be very difficult. And one of the reasons why it's difficult is that the Strait of Hormuz would then have to be declared basically Iran's property, because then you say, well, Iran is in control of the Strait of Hormuz. And Iran will then say, this will be a source of revenue for us. Anybody who goes through the Strait of Hormuz has to pay us. And this would be a huge setback. This would be a total defeat, because now you've gone from one situation where there was freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz to another whereby Iran is now extracting revenue from ships that want to pass.
We have to point out, Joe, that's not a unique situation. Many of the choke points around the world, the Suez Canal, the Egyptian government makes money off of transit there. So it's not a unique situation. Mark, it's really early, even though maybe the cheerleaders of this conflict in Tel Aviv, London, or in Washington or whatever, they may be looking about how to wind this up. But I know it's really days, but when we look at the conflict in Ukraine, the three of us, still in the minority, we believe there will be a military solution to that problem because the West is unwilling to engage in good faith. How does this conflict end? Does it end politically or does it end militarily?
It ends economically.
Okay, good.
I don't think there is a military solution. Iran, you know, can survive, but they can't destroy Israel or the United States. And absent the use of nuclear weapons, which would make them international pariahs, Israel and the United States have demonstrated that they can't destroy or regime change Iran. And I don't believe that there is much appetite for political settlement, at least not at the moment. But it's the economic damage that's going to take us there. The Financial Times had an excellent article this week examining by Nicholas Mulder, examining that the era of U.S. dominance of economic warfare is over. And the U.S. has long used sanctions, tariffs under Trump, its control of the global financial architecture, cutting off from SWIFT. You know, they've weaponized it. They've used it to control, to leverage, to blackmail other countries around the world. But now the same thing is being done to them. The Chinese have put the U.S. over the barrel on rare earths, which they need for their high-tech military and electronics industries. And now Iran is doing the same thing with the Strait of Hormuz and with tit-for-tat attacks on Gulf state energy infrastructure, which are making the global energy markets scream. They're making the global fertilizer market scream. They're making the global agriculture market scream. They're making the global economy scream until Trump and Israel stop and accede to their demands. This is an asymmetric response to what the U.S. has done, and The Trump administration has no answer for it yet. They have no way of freeing the Strait of Hormuz. They have no way to stop Iran's retaliatory strikes against its Gulf state vassals. And it is this economic damage, especially going into a midterm election season, right? Prices for gasoline in the United States are already going through the roof. Food, everything else, inflation across the board is going to very quickly follow. All the U.S. allies from Japan and South Korea are beginning looking at energy fuel rationing. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare for Trump, and he doesn't want to lose to the Democrats and spend the next couple of years fighting impeachment in the country.
Or going to prison. Okay.
This has been a military, economic, and political debacle for Trump that is almost certainly going to be, you know, the effective end of his emperorship, presidency, whatever you want to call it.
I agree with that. George, real quick, can Trump start saying no to Israel?
Well, in theory, he can, but I think this one's going to be very difficult for him.
Yeah.
Because the stakes here are much higher than they were in the case of Gaza. I mean, he doesn't really care that much about Gaza. It's just a piece of territory, you know, build real estate, don't build real estate. Here, we're talking about leaving the Strait of Hormuz in the control of Iran. That has enormous geopolitical ramifications. And Iran being part of the global axis of resistance would have a huge boost in its international reputation. So Iran would come out of this, you know, a kind of an international hero. So that's why the issue of the nuclear weapons cannot entirely be taken off the table, because if it really seems that there's no way out of this other than leaving Iran as, in effect, the victor of this war, then I think there will be pressure, particularly within Israel, to go that extra
mile. All right, let's
using nuclear weapons.
Let's jump off that bridge when we get to it. Okay, fascinating discussion, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests here in Moscow and in Budapest. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, cross stock rules.